Hello, and welcome to Local Matters. My special guest today is Dr. Mike Birdwell, Michael Birdwell, professor of history at Tennessee Tech University. And we're going to be talking about the special month of November in American military history, American history in general. Welcome back, Bird.
Thank you, Bob. Always glad to be here.
Well, it's great to see you again. I run into you across campus and at Rotary and in other places, but always good to have you on the air. Well, some of the folks that are listening may not know you very well, so tell everybody a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, I am a native Cookevillian. I did my undergraduate and master's degrees at Tech, and then I went on to get my PhD at University of Tennessee in cultural history. And my primary interests are film history and World War I and Appalachian history. And those three fit together quite well, actually.
Well, we may get into that a little bit and talk about how Appalachian history fits World War I. And I know at least some of the answers to that, and then film history too, sort of the same connection. So it'd be sort of fun to talk about those. Let's talk a little bit first, though, about film history. You've done some documentaries there that have been pretty cool on PBS and other places.
Yeah, I've worked on 24 documentaries now. The first one I ever worked on was with PBS, with the Biography Channel about Alvin York, and then I worked with History Channel about histories and mysteries about the Black Legion. Much of the stuff that I've done with documentaries have had to do with military history in some way. World War I, World War II, Vietnam, that's what most of them have dealt with. But then also worked on one with Louis Alvarez and New American Media about class in America called People Like Us, and that was a really interesting documentary to work on.
I bet it was. I bet it was. Well, maybe we'll talk about each of those a little bit if we have time. But you're primarily a teacher of history, and I ask you to come in to talk about this special month of November in American history. Lots of commemorative activity, Veterans Day, just a lot of things going on that are pretty special. So tell us a little bit about the month of November and some of the things that go on.
Well, November, of course, is most important, in my opinion, for being the month that we honor our veterans. Now, it started out as an Armistice Day right after World War I on November the 11th. At 11 o'clock in the morning on November the 11th, there was the treaty, the truce, that ended World War I, which is later led to the Treaty of Versailles later. But we lost so many people in those 4 years. We're still trying to debate exactly how many people died, but if you take the flu victims and the civilians and the military casualties, you're approaching 40 million, which people don't realize that. They think that World War I was a much smaller scale war than World War I. What skews World War II's numbers are all the civilians, but we had civilian casualties in World War I also. And so beginning with the British, they started what they called Remembrance Day on November the 11th, and then we quickly come on and follow suit. All the Allies did. We're the only one of the Allies that calls it Armistice Day or Veterans Day. The rest of them call it Remembrance Day. And if you've ever been in England and been in London on November the 11th, it is quite an affair. The last time I was there was 2018 and got to see some of the last ever, no, sorry, 2017, I see one of the very last World War I veterans who went up to the cenotaph, was met by the Queen. It was what a dry eye.
I bet.
Anyway.
I bet. Yeah, that'd be an emotional experience. And you mentioned something unique about that period, and that was the flu.
Yes.
So we're sort of in a new pandemic now, but talk about how the flu affected World War I and the communities around it.
I think it's interesting that, you know, we call the flu the Spanish flu or the swine flu. It did not originate in Spain. It did not. Pigs were not the vector. It originated at Camp Funston in Kansas. It is the American flu.
How about that?
And people reacted the same way they did today. People who didn't wear masks were called mask slackers. people didn't want to wear masks. There was no vaccine. But it's interesting the way people dealt with it. They put people together in wards, which actually accelerated the number of people who got the flu.
Wow.
And how many people died. And in East Tennessee, Johnson City, the medical doctor there, the head honcho, told people to strip all the linens off their beds, to take all the shears and the drapes down from the windows, and everything that was cloth, because he said that could carry the flu.
That's where the bugs live.
They were to drag those out and set them all on fire.
Wow.
And then to wash the lintels of their doorways down with creosote. Of course, that didn't do anything except people didn't have anything to sleep under and then made their house stinky. But you get the same kind of reactions as today. People don't want to listen to people in authority, and they don't want their individual liberties challenged in any way. And people are dying as a result.
It's shocking today to hear some of the stories of folks that have chosen to exercise their right. And some people say their right to free speech, and others say their right to be stupid. But whichever way you view that, I guess it's a right.
Yeah. I trust science.
Yeah, I do too. In this case, no question. Well, World War One was a trench war, wasn't it? And so it wasn't fought in the communities. And the bombings weren't as bad in the communities.
No, World War One becomes a stagnant war by Christmas of 1914. And the front lines don't move appreciably until 1917. And so you've got this static warfare. There were literally 25,000 miles of trench that were dug between the North Sea and the Swiss border. The circumference of the earth is 24,000 miles. It's what some soldiers called the troglodyte world. Now, most Americans were not involved in trench warfare because the Ludendorff offensive had moved the soldiers out of the trenches. And so for most Americans, it was open warfare, which we're much more accustomed to. But there were the 1st American Marine Division, they fought in the trenches. A couple of other smaller units fought in the trenches. But if you go to Europe today, you still see the trenches.
Yeah, I've stood in some of those trenches in the Argonne area, and you and I both were going to be talking about some of the things that happened there.
Yeah, and there was so much ordnance that was sent off in the war from cannon and such things. There's still millions of pounds of explosives that have not detonated. So every year you read about some farmer in France or Belgium who's out there plowing his field and gets blown up, and so it's still a volatile area.
And I think farmers still plow up remains of soldiers
absolutely
at this point too.
Every year,
There is. I know in Verdun there is a ossuary of bones that
they keep adding to.
Yeah, and they say they add every year to it.
And Arras, I think it was 2020. Some farmers were out, working in their fields, and they found bones of soldiers that ended up being almost a company of Australian soldiers who've been buried alive.
Been buried alive.
Yeah.
Wow.
So.
Wow. Yeah, it was a treacherous war. There's no question. So November becomes an armistice day, and then the Treaty of Versailles, and then Hitler rubs that in the French and other countries' noses back 20 years later.
And justifiably so in some cases, because the Germans didn't start the war. It was started by the Russians and the Austrians. And so, Germany had to sign the War Guilt Clause saying that they alone were responsible for the war. And Hitler used that to his advantage. And the Treaty of Versailles also said that the Germans had to demilitarize. The Germans are very good at building weapons. And several other, strings, they had to pay the war debt. So several, unfair things were placed upon the Germans. And if Woodrow Wilson had been listened to with his 14 points, maybe things would have been differently. But, I don't play counterfactual history, but it's possible that Hitler would not have come to power had it not been for the Versailles Treaty.
Wow. And it since they couldn't militarize, they really got good at building commercial airplanes that could be turned into bombers.
That's
true. And other things like that. So, yeah, Hitler, that's an interesting history. And again, a lot of the month of November has a lot to do with it. Well, World War One was also called the war to end all wars. It certainly didn't do that. But tell us briefly about that history, and then we'll take a quick break.
Well, the United States, we did not want to be involved in the war. So when the war was declared in August of 1914, we thought we'd just sit back and watch. But, of course, we couldn't just sit back and watch. We provided materiel to both sides. We didn't think that'd be a problem. Of course, that's going to lead to the Lusitania incident in 1915, when Lusitania was a British liner, the Cunard line, and it had been refitted so it could carry weapons and ammunition. And the Germans said that they're going to blow this thing up. And they said, if you're an American, don't get on the boat. 230 Americans got on the boat, including one of the Rockefellers. And we narrowly averted war in 1915, when the Germans were willing to stop unrestricted submarine warfare in return for us continuing to sell them oil and things of that nature. And the United States gets nearly drug in on more than one occasion, but what really dragged us in was after the French fall at Verdun, when the Russians are suing for a separate peace, and the Germans started back unrestricted submarine warfare. And so in the fall and winter of 1916 going into 1917, they were sinking ships willy-nilly, including the city of Memphis. And when the city of Memphis was sunk, Scott County, Tennessee, had a special meeting of their county commission, and Scott County declared war on Germany before the rest of the United States did.
Well, we're going to come back after a break and do a little more of that Trivial Pursuit like that. This is Local Matters. We will take a quick break.
What's so important about shopping with locally owned businesses?
When you shop local, your hard-earned dollars stay here in the community, helping to benefit your friends and neighbors, local schools, roads, and all aspects of community life.
But what happens to my money if I spend it online or at a national chain store?
In most cases, the profits go far away, out of state, corporate headquarters, or even overseas.
It doesn't take any extra effort to shop local. OfficeMart on South Jefferson and Cookeville is your locally owned office furniture and supply store. For over 35 years, they've been proud to serve businesses in the Upper Cumberland with quality and value. You get real customer service, too. And unlike shopping online, you can actually see and try out the large inventory of office furniture in their showroom. And when it's delivered, it's not a box on your step. They're glad to install and set up everything. OfficeMart. There's no other locally owned office store in the region. South Jefferson Avenue across from Hardee's. Shop local at OfficeMart.
Welcome back to Local Matters. We are talking to Dr. Mike Birdwell, the professor of history at Tennessee Tech, one of the professors of military history. And we're talking about the month of November, but Bird, you just made an interesting comment that one of our Upper Cumberland counties, or at least we count it as Upper Cumberland, Scott County, actually declared war on Germany before the United States did.
Yes, they did. After the sinking of the city of Memphis, and the sinking of ships got every American's attention. And so, Woodrow Wilson ran for re-election on the slogan, "He kept us out of war." And so when he's inaugurated on March the 4th, it's only a month later, he asked for a war declaration. So on April the 2nd, he goes and asks for a war declaration. It was debated heavily for 4 days, and then the United States declares war on April the 6th. But we don't have a military. Our standing army as such is just straggling back from Mexico, where they were trying to look for Pancho Villa to no avail. And so we didn't know how to raise an army. We didn't know how many people we needed. We never needed anything on this scale. The British said that we needed 4 million soldiers, and our standing army was roughly 300,000. So how do you go from 300,000 to 4 million? We don't have enough weapons. We don't have enough uniforms. We don't have any real training camps. So that transformation from Pacific life to military life was drastic in the extreme in World War One. And for most Tennesseans, they either went to Atlanta, where they were at Camp Gordon, which is where Alvin York was, or they went to Greenville, South Carolina, to create Camp Sevier. It was just a piney woods forest, and they created it whole cloth, and it went from having a population of a couple of hundred to 30,000 in about 3 months.
Wow.
And so and that's all the training camps were like that, where they went from being a cornfield or something else to suddenly being this, you know, teeming population of young soldiers.
Sounds like the history of Oak Ridge in World War II in a lot of ways too.
Very similar.
You've mentioned Scott County and Alvin York, and we're going to spend a little bit of time on Alvin York, but before we do that, you served as chairman of the Great War Commission for the state of Tennessee, and that commemorated a special anniversary. Talk about what that commission did and what's ongoing.
Yeah, well, Governor Haslam appointed me and nine other people to be a part of this Tennessee Great War Commission. We eventually had 11 people on there, and our job was to go across the state and record as many stories as we could about Tennessee's role in World War One. So we had held three symposia a year. We went into several of the 95 counties where we have state library and archives that set up these booths, and people could come and bring their whatever they had, and we would either film it or scan it so that they got to take what they had home with them. Those are now part of the permanent collection that's online, and if you go online to the Tennessee State Library and Archives, to the Over Here and Over There, you know, browser, it has all the stuff that we collected. Have a book that hasn't come out yet about Tennessee and the Great War, and we also refurbished some old plaques. Got things reinstated. For example, at Percy Warner Park, we have those two plaques there were refurbished. There was a plaque that was refurbished in Jackson, Tennessee. We got new historical markers up and things of that nature. And I really wanted to go through 2019 and bring the boys home, but we ended on November the 11th at Tech. We had a vintage football game. We had a symposium there. And then at the Alvin C. York site. So it really came to a close at those two places in 2018.
Well, that's great. And I know I attended a couple of the events and saw you in action in a lot of those. Tell us about the book.
Well, the book is it's called Tennesseans of the Great War, which is not the title I chose, but the book is finished. It's just COVID has messed everything up, so we should be getting the galleys any day now, and then hopefully it'll be out the first of next year. It's clearly not going to come out this year, but we have scholars from across the state who submitted works, and so the very first chapter is about Carol Busey. It's about what was going on in Tennessee as we were not involved in the war, and she had her opening line is that, on the day that the Archduke was assassinated, Tennesseans were worried about the weather.
How about that? Yeah.
And then Emmett Essen has the second chapter. It's about mules and the role mules played in the war. Tennessee provided a million mules that we provided.
Wow.
Then the third chapter is about Kiffin Rockwell and his brother, Paul, who they joined the French Foreign Legion, fought in France in 1914. Kiffin was invalided out and became one of the original 16 pilots in the Lafayette Escadrille. It's an amazing story. And then the creation of the powder plant at Old Hickory. They broke ground on March the 8th, 1918, and produced their first million pounds on July the 1st.
Wow.
Which is just an amazing feat.
And that was the DuPont legacy at Old Hickory.
Yes.
Yeah.
And during the war, there was an impetus to conserve more land, and it was militarily driven. But George Webb has the next to last chapter about the creation of Great Smoky Mountains National Park, and then the final chapter is about the attempt to kidnap the Kaiser.
How about that? Well, tell us about the attempt to to
kidnap the Kaiser.
Kidnap the Kaiser.
Luke Lee, who was a grandee from Bellmead, he started the Nashville Tennessean newspaper. He was our last appointed senator from the state of Tennessee before Kenneth McKellar replaced him after the 17th Amendment. And McKellar liked to stir things up. Luke Lee liked to stir things up. And so when war is declared, Luke Lee decides he wants to go, but he's too old. And so he gets a bunch of friends of his together from Bellmead, and they persuade folks, because he'd been on the Military Affairs Committee, to make an exception. So they get a Spanish-American War veteran cannon, or vintage cannon, and he and his buddies from Bellmead, they join the 30th Division. They're sent to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, to learn about how to do artillery. Then he goes over, with his buddies, and doesn't see much action. But then they read that the Kaiser has abdicated his throne. He's fled to a place called Amerongen in the Netherlands, and so they decide that they're going to go steal some command cars. They steal a Cadillac and a Winton Flyer, and they're going to go kidnap the Kaiser and force him to go to the Versailles Conference. And it was going to be the Christmas present for Woodrow Wilson. What it ends up being is an 8-day drunk with these guys just roaming all over the place. The Winton keeps breaking down. The Cadillac was okay. They make it to the castle where the Kaiser was. They never get to see him. But Larry MacPhail, who's known as Mr. Baseball, he stole an ashtray that belonged to the Kaiser. And the MacPhail family still has that ashtray.
How about that? Well, it sounds like he got an adventure out of the deal.
He did.
Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. We will be right back. This is Local Matters, and we're talking to Mike Birdwell. Welcome back to Local Matters. We are talking to Dr. Mike Birdwell from Tennessee Tech, and we're talking about the month of November and the Veterans Day activities, the Armistice Day across the world. The kinds of remembrance that have gone on since World War I. But, Bird, we probably need to pay attention to the most famous American that came, and certainly the most famous Tennessean in World War I, in terms of Medal of Honor. So let's talk about Alvin York. You're right. Conservator of the Alvin York Collection at Tennessee Tech and the Archives. Tell us about Sergeant York.
Well, what I want to do is tell people what they don't know, because most people think that Alvin York, that his unit was just sent into the area around Chatel Chahry, but with not knowing what the reason was. There's no Alvin York story without the Lost Battalion. And Charles Whittlesey, who was an attorney, had been an attorney before the war, wore Coke bottle thick glasses, looked sort of like John Lennon, had no military experience, but Whittlesey joined the 77th New York Infantry, and he was a colonel when he is deployed to the area about 5 to 10 miles from Chatel Chahry. And they called them the Lost Battalion. They weren't lost. We knew where they were the entire time. They weren't a battalion either. It was 500 men, roughly, and they got trapped between American lines and enemy lines. And so at Charlevoix Mill, they dug in, and unfortunately, where they dug in was just at where basically the artillery from both sides are crossing over.
Oh, man.
And so they lost lots of folks to friendly fire and to enemy fire. If it hadn't been for pigeons, they would have lost any kind of communication with them. And the hero of that was a pigeon named Ma Cherie, or My Sweetie. And that pigeon took the message to the American command, saying, "Would you quit shooting at us?" And the pigeon lost a leg, got a leg shot off, and got a wing wounded, but made it back to let folks know. And so in the period between, it's a six-day period, where they can't get to the Lost Battalion. The 82nd Division was, they were on parade, I mean, excuse me, they were on rest after the Battle of Samael. And so they took the 2nd Brigade and they said, okay, we're going to put you back in action. And what we want you to do is to capture the railroad that is supplying the Germans to get their artillery and their ammunition so they can keep tearing up the Wehrmacht battalion. And so on October the 5th is when the 82nd Division starts moving back into place. And then on the 7th of October, they're about to make their move, big push forward, and they're stopped in their tracks. Now, what they don't know is that Whittlesey gets rescued on the 7th. But we still have a mission. We have to take up that railroad. And so where they were stopped in their tracks is where three mountain peaks essentially come together, and there's this valley. And so York was not in command. Sergeant Bernard Early was in command. And he told the guys, we need to flank the hill, come around, take out the machine gun nest so the advance can go forward. And so 17 men are part of this detail to go take out those machine gun nests, and that's exactly what they do. There were four machine gun nests in the area. They only had to take out one. And it's interesting, if you read York's Medal of Honor citation, it says that after they took out the machine gun nest, six more Germans charged them down the hill. Well, you've been to that place.
I've been to that place.
You can't charge down that hill.
No.
And so I've tried it. I went head over heels down that hill. And so that changes everything, because when you think charge, you think these people coming quickly, but they're scooting down the hill. It's giving York more time to take aim. And so we know that there were 25 Germans who were killed. We know that York got the lion's share of them. We'll never know how many for certain. But when he and then there are only seven survivors, they make their way back to the command post. And the command post, you know, they're still trying to take out the railroad. And they're like, yeah, just move on, move on. And York has 132 prisoners. And they said, well, here, take these. And so he and eight guys end up escorting 200 German prisoners to Varennes, where they can be processed. And so nobody knows that part, seems like to me. And so it's a much bigger story. And Whittlesey, of course, gets the Medal of Honor. York gets the Medal of Honor. Pershing's number one hero was a guy named Samuel Woodfill, who was regular Army. Those three guys were all at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier when it was dedicated in 1920. And Whittlesey suffered from survivor's guilt and committed suicide with less than a month after that meeting in Washington.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. I had not heard the suicide part of that story, but I have stood in the spot where Sergeant York was and where the Lost Battalion was. And what amazed me, and you told me this before I went, it amazed me how much it looks like where Alvin York grew up.
The terrain looks like Fentress County. It looks like you could be in Daniel Boone National Forest or Pickett State Park. The similarity is absolutely astounding.
Yeah, it is, and I've also heard you say, and I've seen the movie, and the movie is a fair representation of facts, but it stretches things
and takes
sort of
some liberties,
as all movies do, I guess.
But, the original movie was called the Amazing Story of Sergeant York. It never got made. I've got a copy of the screenplay. And it starts with the ticker tape parade down Madison Avenue, and then it ends with York opening the doors of York Institute.
How about that?
The war's not mentioned at all.
That's amazing. So it's the afterlife. Yeah. And let's talk about that afterlife, because Alvin York did a lot after the war that was Medal of Honor worthy also.
I would say that what he did after the war was more important than what he did during the war.
I agree.
Because he was functionally illiterate, when he was drafted. He was 30 years old when he's drafted. He had no experience. He'd done some carpentry work and things of that nature, but he didn't have a marketable skill. But he comes back and realizes, he said this in more than one speech, he realized he was ignorant. And you can cure ignorant. And so he dedicated the rest of his life to education in some form or fashion. And so it is because of Alvin York that Tennessee got the compulsory education legislation in 25 when the rest of the South gets it's not till the New Deal, not till the mid-30s. York butted heads with folks in Fentress County who did not want education. I've heard more than one person say that if you give a kid an education, you might as well put a postage stamp on them.
Yeah, they're going to move away.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That means they're not going to come back, though.
Right.
And so he did that. He spent time trying to get better roads to the area. He worked on all kinds of internal improvements. And he wanted to be remembered for education, not for anything else.
Well, he's certainly a hero for the Upper Cumberland and for Fentress County. The York site is a hubbub of activities in year-round, but month of November has some special things going on. Talk about the York site and how it was created and sort of what happens up there.
Okay. Well, the obviously York site, when Alvin died in 1964, and his wife, Gracie, was kind of at a loss. She had 400 acres. You know, could she take care of this and all this business? And so some people from state parks moved in and said, could they turn it into a state shrine? They didn't call it a park yet. A state shrine. She could live there. She could do anything she wanted with the house. But she could be happy in knowing that it's going to be taken care of no matter what happens to her. So for the longest, the only thing that was really accessible to the public was the mill. But over time, more things were added, more things were made accessible to the public, so that under the Bredesen administration, there was a real push to let's turn this into a true working historical site. And where Bredesen had an idea that was very modest in scope, Bill Haslam said, we're going to make this a full-fledged, you know, destination. And so the house has been almost completely renovated. Much of the grounds look like they did before York died. So they took out a lot of the metal fencing and things of that nature, put back native plants. We have dug a trench back in behind the house in one of the pastures so that we can do demonstrations and normally, we do this stuff on November the 11th, but this year, because November 11th is a Thursday, there'll be things going on at the site on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And so there'll be the big event will be on the 11th at 11 o'clock, and there'll be things happening in the morning and things happening in the afternoon. We have York Airfield. There'll be biplanes taking off and landing. We have a 75-millimeter French artillery piece that we're going to have access to, so we'll be dry firing that thing. There'll be all kinds of demonstrations, and it's fit for everybody, all age groups, and I'll be leading tours in the house. We will ask that people wear masks in the house just because of the close proximity, but there's going to be, I'm sure there'll be good food, there always is. There'll be music, there'll be plenty to do that weekend.
Well, I wish we had time to continue talking. We've got another hour's worth of stories, and sometime we'll have you back and
sounds good.
I'll let you tell some of the funny stories about Sergeant York. And
there
are a bunch, and they'd be worth a show. It's been great to have you here, Bird, and it's always good to talk about Tennessee history and American military history. The month of November is a special time, and we certainly don't want to forget the impact Sergeant York had on us.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks for being here.